If you would like to work directly with Dr. Cole to maximize your sleep quality with a comprehensive sleep coaching program, or if you're concerned that you have sleep apnea, or simply just want a second opinion consultation, she's now available to see patients in New Jersey, New York, California, and Georgia, with more states coming soon. Please visit oak.care/sleep for a complete list of telemedicine services with transparent pricing. You deserve rapid access to quality sleep care with a physician you can trust to have your back every step of the way on your journey to better sleep.
Hi, I'm Dr. Allison Cole, sleep medicine specialist and bona fide chronic insomniac. Welcome to the Sleep is My Waking Passion podcast. Remember, knowledge is empowerment, and if applied correctly, it can help you biohack your way to a better night of sleep, just like I did. All right. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Sleep is My Waking Passion podcast. This is going to be a very cool topic, one I'm certainly have not been an expert in, but I definitely have my ability to understand has really increased through listening to this woman speak. I want to introduce Dr. Beth Ann Mallow. She is professor of neurology and pediatrics at Vanderbilt. She's director of the Vanderbilt Sleep Division. She holds the Burry Endowed Chair in Cognitive Childhood Development and serves as vice chair for academic affairs in the Department of Neurology and director of the Vanderbilt Kennedy Center Clinical Translational Care. I don't know how many hats you could possibly wear, my darling, and yet make time for me. So I am very, very blessed. As we get started and you hear her speak, you're going to see. I mean, she's just dynamite. I listened to her at the New Jersey Sleep Symposium, and I was just telling her that I was fangirling so hard. I was so excited when she accepted the invitation to come on the program. So I'm going to start, Beth, by asking you this. How did you even become interested in autism spectrum disorder and how that relates to sleep? What led to this journey of yours?
Thank you so much for having me, Allison. Honestly, I have two sons on the autism spectrum. They're doing great. And they struggled with sleep when they were younger. I realized it was really important to help them sleep and also to be closer to people with autism so that they could help me as I navigated being a parent for them. I looked into the literature, and there just wasn't a lot out there on autism and sleep back in the early 2000s that was clinically based. There were research papers on having more eye movements during rapid eye movement sleep or various other kinds of researchy type of things, but not a whole lot that would help parents whose kids were waking up at 2 a.m. screaming.
So we didn't have a lot of practical application stuff that you could do. Wow.
No, and I realized that was super important.
Not only that, we all have challenges in our lives, and certainly having two sons, I'm sure, has been a challenge for you who are on the spectrum, but you've taken something that could be a challenge and you've turned it into good. So it's just amazing how many people you have helped with your research and just with your knowledge, both from the personal as well as the professional side of things. So kudos to you. Would you mind sharing with everyone? We talk about autism. We talk about being on the spectrum. Can you define it a little bit for folks? Because even for myself, having a friend of mine whose child was diagnosed, it can be very subtle sometimes. And, you know, what are people looking for? What's your experience been? You know, how are people looking at this disorder?
Yeah, so it is a spectrum disorder. That's why we call it autism spectrum. And actually, I use the word disorder. I just want to correct myself there. I would say condition or trait, because it is for certain people a real struggle. And the reason we sometimes use the word disorder or condition is because we know that if something is defined in that way, they can get a lot of help and a lot of support. On the other hand, there are people who are autistic adults. That's who they are. And it's more a way of being in the world. So I just want to be clear from the outset that this isn't about labeling in a negative way or a positive way or whatever. I try to use the term autism spectrum rather than autism spectrum disorder, because for some people it is a trait, right? It's just some way of being in the world. I am focused, though, on trying to help everybody reach their potential. So helping people with sleep, helping people with other aspects of the condition. And when we talk about autism spectrum, the two biggest key features that we need to help people with, or we need to help people improve in so that they can be in the world and reach their goals. One is challenges with communicating with others. This could take the form of their language being limited, not necessarily being able to communicate verbally, although they may very well understand what's being said to them, or their language is intact, but they miss cues. They miss subtle back and forth when you're in conversation with someone. They miss eye contact, body language, those kinds of things. That's as much of a struggle in terms of social communication as the language can be. And then the other area is restricted repetitive behaviors. In other words, being super focused on a particular interest or feeling like you have to move your hands a certain way or stim a certain way. Sometimes that's in relief for anxiety. Sometimes the restricted interests are actually a good thing. Like if you're super interested, for example, in construction or engineering or the financial system or any other myriad of things, it can actually be your segue into a really rewarding career. Those are the key features of autism that we see. And it really is a spectrum. Some kids are brilliant from an intellectual standpoint. Others might have intellectual disability. Some people can speak really well. Others have limited language. So it really is a spectrum of conditions.
I so appreciate the way you describe that, because you're really highlighting that we're not trying to sit here and have a conversation where we're trying to pass judgment as something is good or something is bad. And you're highlighting the fact that truly, as the word says, it's a huge spectrum of folks. There's just such a wide range of how folks present. And to your point, what some of their limitations might be. How common do they think autism spectrum is currently?
It's felt to now affect 1 in 36 kids.
Wow.
The CDC does these studies every so often, these surveillance studies, and that's the latest data, 1 in 36. You have to realize back in 2000, it was when my oldest son was diagnosed, it was 1 in 198. So it's gone from close to 1 in 200 to 1 in 36 in 23 years.
Do you think it's how we define it? Do you think we have better tools for diagnosing it? Or do you think there's something intrinsic that's going on that it's just more common?
Yes. In other words, yes, yes, and yes.
I love that answer. It's a little bit of this and a little bit of that.
I think it's all three. I really do. I mean, I think it's more awareness, it's better diagnosis, and there's probably something out there in our environment or genetics that we haven't really captured. And of course, there's what Malcolm Gladwell and others will talk about, tipping points, where you see autism in a friend's child or someone else, and then you're like, I wonder if I should get my child tested. So there's the more of it that's out there, the more of it people recognize and then pursue. I suspect that looking back on my childhood, there are a lot of people I knew who probably were on the autism spectrum, but they weren't diagnosed as such. And now I think it's a good thing in a way. There's more awareness, so people can get the help they need sooner. And that could make a huge difference in outcomes. And again, goal is to be able to meet your personal goals and live the best life that you can. And that increased awareness can help with that.
Oh, I love how you put that. That's fantastic. Now, you have done some research involving sleep and kids with autism spectrum. Can you share with the audience what you found? Because you guys were looking at the Autism Treatment Network Registry, and this data just blew my mind.
We have done a whole bunch of different things in the last 20 years. I'm very proud of all of it. The work that we did with Autism Treatment Network is one of the most meaningful for me. And what I specifically am proud of is the treatment trials that we've done, and we could get to those. But, you know, we initially looked at what the sleep problems were in kids and to some extent adolescents with autism. I'm still putting a dip in the water with the adults. I've done a little bit of work with adults, but specifically I focused on kids and adolescents. And what we found was that the biggest concern was difficulty falling asleep and staying asleep. We call that insomnia. We took a very practical approach to that and said, what are all the different causes that might contribute to these problems? And some of this is biological, some of it's genetic, some of it's being overactive in your brain. You can't shut your brain down. That's something a lot of kids will say or adults will say to me, is my brain just is wired where I can't relax. But sometimes it's something as simple as the medical conditions that go along with autism, such as increased seizures or GI stomach type problems, or it could be the medicines that you're taking for things like depression or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, which are both more common in autism. It could also be behavioral, environmental causes of sleep problems. We all have this. We watching TV or being on our screens. Kids with autism have a certain preference for screens and video games, and that bright light, that we call it blue light from those devices, can be very stimulating and interfere with sleep. It could be the need to have a really solid bedtime routine and having trouble transitioning from one activity to another at bedtime, which can interfere with sleep. We know having that ability to transition smoothly through a bedtime routine can help you fall asleep. It could be things like caffeine, and there's lots of different reasons. So that was the first thing that my group did, was focused in on what are the problems, what are the causes, what are the contributors. And then over time, we got into what kinds of interventions, what kinds of treatments can we do to really make a difference for kids with autism?
So in your research, I saw that like 71% of kids with autism spectrum have some sort of a sleep problem. So you're saying the majority of it is primarily insomnia. I had read about parasomnias, or these behaviors that you could do at night. Did you find that to also be something in your research that people have? And could you describe a little bit about some of those behaviors that people might see?
Yeah, definitely. And it's not just me. There have been some other groups as well who have looked at parasomnias in autism. Parasomnia is defined as any unusual behavior during sleep that can happen. So it can be sleepwalking, it can be nightmares, it could be something called sleep terrors, where kids will yell out in the middle of the night. It can be even things like eating in your sleep. There's all sorts of unusual things that can happen in your sleep. And these do appear in some studies to be more common in autism. It's tricky because sometimes kids will wake up in the middle of the night, and due to anxiety, they'll scream or they'll get out of bed to find their parents. So it's tricky sometimes whether it's a parasomnia or a night waking, especially in somebody with autism or a seizure. So we've noticed that to be the case. But you're absolutely right. I mean, parasomnias defined, like I just said, sleepwalking, night terrors can certainly be up there. Kids with autism are also not immune from having sleep apnea or restless legs or those kinds of conditions as well, which are pretty common in the general population, and those can affect sleep too.
Do those types of disorders like sleep apnea or like the restless legs, is that similar in an autism spectrum child versus the statistics for quote unquote normal. I hate using that term, but like quote unquote normal kids or don't have that.
Yeah. You could say of typical development. Yeah. I mean, we know that apnea is pretty common. It's about 1-3% in the general population. It may be more common in autism, particularly in teens and adults because of the coexisting condition of obesity in autism due to sedentary lifestyles or some of the psychotropic meds that have been prescribed for aggression and other conditions. It's still common. Like even if sleep apnea is not more common in kids on the autism spectrum, it's definitely worth treating because we know that any sleep problem is going to affect how you function during the day. So if you've got a kid with autism who's struggling at school, having meltdowns, aggression, can't focus, treating that sleep apnea can be huge in terms of keeping them in school, helping them be the best they can be, reaching their goals. So there's that. Even if it's more common, these other sleep disorders are important to treat because they could really make a difference for the child and the family.
Oh, yes.
Can you imagine what it's like for your child to wake up 2 a.m. every night? It takes a toll on these families. They're very stressed.
So this is really, in part, the treatment. Yes, we want to optimize the child and their ability to be achieving and successful in their own right as they grow older, but we also are kind of treating the family too. And I think that often gets left out in a lot of the conversation is just the quality of life for the family as well.
And the reason that's important, I mean, quality of life for the family is obviously important, but what I've also seen, anybody who's listening as a mom knows the days that your kids act out the most and have the most meltdowns are the days when you're stressed. Why are my kids melting down today of all days? I am so stressed today. I don't need this today. And one day a light bulb went off and I realized that the reason they were acting out was because I was stressed. So there's a huge connection between the parent being stressed and sleep deprived and how the child behaves. So if we can get the parents more sleep, it actually isn't a selfish thing. It's helping their children because they're going to be less stressed and then their kids are going to be less stressed.
I'm going to segue and just insert a tiny little story about myself, which is I came to this realization when I decided I was going to switch paths and sort of pursue doing the podcast and doing some educational work over what I was doing, because I had treated patients during the COVID pandemic and everything. And there's not a single time in my life where I've been that stressed. And on the regular, my kids were like, I mean, they were just evil. My poor mom who helped me out during that entire pandemic, they were just, you know, it was like meltdown after meltdown and all. She's just like, Allison, man, I don't know what to do with these kids. And when I made that transition and I noticed, I think really to your point, it was when I didn't seem so tense and so stressed, when I could be more present for them. And I was also sleeping better because I wasn't taking call and doing some of the other things I was doing that were really making me sleep deprived. It all cycled into a better relationship with my children too. So this is basically along that same line. And I really appreciate you highlighting that because I've seen it even in my own world. And to your point, any mom out there, just think about that. Like deep breath, you know, whatever we can do to keep ourselves calm, it actually does translate to our children. Bravo. Bravo for stating it so eloquently. Out of curiosity, would you mind talking a little bit about kind of what we think about genetics? Because there's been some chatter that like maybe people who have mentioned that melatonin may be helpful for treating children, sort of moving into treatment a little bit, but there may be a genetic reason for that. Is that we think that they may have some issue with how much melatonin they produce, for example?
Yeah, melatonin is really fascinating. It seems to help kids with autism and ADHD as well, more than typically developing children. And we're not exactly sure why. We think it may be because there could be a melatonin deficiency in some of these kids. In some studies, it's been shown that they don't make as much melatonin or the breakdown product is lower. We actually did a research study with a small number of kids, like 10 kids, and we found normal melatonin profiles. We drew their blood overnight and everything checked out to be pretty normal. But as I said earlier, there's so much variability. It's like a spectrum. So it wouldn't surprise me if there's some kids who have a melatonin deficiency, even if they don't all have that. As a result, melatonin's gotten a lot of press. I mean, it also in research studies has been shown to decrease anxiety and to help turn off your brain. So there's those reasons as well why it might work. We found that in multiple studies, and not just, again, when I say we, I don't mean just me. There's been many other researchers who've worked with melatonin. We have found that it does improve time to fall asleep, and it can help kids struggle less at bedtime. Certain preparations of melatonin, like extended release, can also help with night wakings. The immediate release oftentimes works better for falling asleep because it's only in your system for a short period of time, while the extended release can help with the night wakings. Even though it's not prescribed, it's a supplement, it does have a lot of benefits. I think the challenge is, and I'd be happy to speak to this, I almost wish we had medications that melatonin was a medicine that was prescribed, because it being a supplement can be very confusing and you can end up with like contaminated, I call it contaminated melatonin, where it's mixed with other things, including things like CBD that shouldn't be in the melatonin.
Or it doesn't even contain what it says it's supposed to contain. In terms of dosing, I had read that maybe 3 milligrams, and I know there is a brand called Remfresh. Guys, I'm not trying to sit here and do a commercial for Remfresh. I'm just speaking that I had a conversation with another sleep neurologist named Pedro Navab, and he had done an integrative medicine kind of fellowship. So he did a little bit of extra training in that. And he was a big fan of that particular product. That's an extended release kind of melatonin. Do you have any feelings on a gummy or any particular brands that you think tend to be of potentially higher quality versus not?
Yeah, I have something to say on that. There is something called a USP. It's a US pharmacopoeia, and it's a verified mark. And what it is, it's the next best thing to having your melatonin go through the Food and Drug Administration and be approved as a drug. It's more evidence that at least you know what you're getting. The FDA at least has audited it and looked at it, and it's not the same rigorous process of going through full FDA approval, but at least you know that the brand is meeting certain standards, and you can look on the label and find it. It's things like, as we talked about, making sure that only melatonin is in the bottle as opposed to CBD or Benadryl or anything else. I know of 2 brands, there may be more, but the 2 brands I know that Natrol, N-A-T-R-O-L, and Nature Made, both are USP. And again, I, like you, don't want to pick any brand over another brand, but the fact that you can look on the bottle and look for USP verification is something that I'd love for your audience to really hang on to, because I think it can make a big difference in terms of just knowing that you're getting melatonin and not something else.
Thank you for that. I have been saying that too. So now you have 2 brands. You don't have to listen to me. I'm just the person hosting this podcast. You've got a respectable person from Vanderbilt telling you this. So listen to her. If you're not going to listen to me, look for those labels. That's really, really hugely important. Dosing wise, like I said, I had heard about 3 milligrams. Is that sort of the most, or is there like a cap, or how does it work?
It's not necessarily by weight. I actually start with 1 milligram. Even with adults, I start with 1 milligram, because why not? Why not use less? And if you could find a 0.5 milligram, do that. And then you can go up in a week to 2 milligrams and then in another week to 3 milligrams if the 1 milligram isn't working. And I say that because you always want to use less, and some people are more sensitive than others, but it isn't by weight, it isn't by age. I tend to dose people the same, whether they're 2-year-olds or 10-year-olds or 40-year-olds. I just start with the lowest dose and go up. And normally we give it 30 minutes before bedtime. Occasionally, if we're using it for somebody who has a really late bedtime, let's say a kid who is 6 years old, but they can't fall asleep until 11 o'clock at night, or a teenager who can't get to bed until after midnight, or an adult who can't get to bed until after midnight, we'll actually dose the melatonin earlier in the evening, like 3 to 5 hours before the desired bedtime. So let's take the 6-year-old who's going to bed at 11 o'clock and really needs to be going to bed at 9 o'clock. We'll dose them at maybe 6 o'clock at night.
Shifting your circadian rhythm. Yeah.
You know, again, a tiny dose. Some people even recommend 0.5 milligram.
Listeners, this is a really important point that Dr. Mallow is highlighting, which is a delayed sleep phase, which is very common in any teenager, for example, basically means they want, you know, when we're kind of tired around 9, 10 o'clock-ish, these folks want to stay up maybe sometimes till like 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning. They really don't feel like they're ready for bed until much later. And then they want to sleep in a little bit later. But that's obviously not always going to be conducive to a longer term solution in terms of how you integrate with things like schoolwork, for example. So being able to sort of shift that circadian rhythm so that you're sleeping a little bit earlier or advancing a sleep phase, as Dr. Mallow pointed out, that's when the use of the melatonin is really significantly earlier on in the evening. What I do find interesting is that you're mentioning, you know, in order to help folks kind of get to sleep potentially 30 minutes before bedtime. In typical folks, I would say oftentimes we have that data hasn't panned out. So in other words, like we kind of don't know that melatonin's all that effective as a sleep supplement. That's also important to know because we're talking about a specific indication. So again, getting back to the focus of this conversation, which is on autism spectrum, that's the key here is that melatonin can be appropriate, but it doesn't mean it's appropriate universally for everybody. So just highlighting that, that's so great.
Yeah, I want to limit this to autism because I've seen a lot of kids who are of typical development who really do fine with behavioral approaches to insomnia. And what I found with the autism population is sometimes they need a little bit more. I always start with the behavioral approaches and that 30-minute period between you're giving the melatonin and they're going to sleep, that's the time to actually do the bedtime routine, the relaxing book, singing, music, whatever your child needs to relax. You don't want to waste that 30 minutes because that's when the melatonin is entering their system, hopefully calming them, turning off their brain, and you want to couple that with a behavioral approach that will get the child ready and calm. Like you don't want to give your child melatonin and then put them in front of a video game. That would be a waste of melatonin.
We've been sprinkling the talk, the importance of behavioral change throughout this, you know, ways that we can improve behavior to really assist. So I think I want to end with that because it sounds like really, no matter what we do, there are a lot of things that we as parents, as loved ones who are caring, especially for children and teens with autism spectrum, can assist them to try to form those better habits over time. Can you share maybe, I don't know, your top five or so ones that you really love that you think are probably, you know, some of the more effective tools in your experience?
Yeah. The most effective tool I've actually found, it's going to sound counterintuitive about what we just talked about, but it actually is delaying that time a little bit. So the 10-year-old who's going to bed at 8 p.m., that's probably too early. And a 9 or 9:30 bedtime is more appropriate and will help them fall asleep easier. Similarly, the teenager should be probably going to bed at 10 o'clock at night rather than 9 o'clock at night. So just a little bit, because what that does is it makes us more tired. It's a fancy term called homeostatic pressure, but your listeners just need to know it. You know, we're going to be more tired, right, if we go to bed a little later. So that's number one. I try to do that. And even if they have early school in the morning, I still try to break the habit by having them go to bed later. And then you can always back it up. But at least you're breaking that cycle of not being tired and lying in bed. And then the kid with autism is going to get anxious. And if they don't have much language, they'll start stimming and just being...
It'll sort of perpetuate the cycle.
Yeah.
And that's important too, because guys, even if you, this is where there's some overlap between typical and autism spectrum. And in this respect, what Dr. Mallow is highlighting are literally tools that we use, even in folks that are quote unquote typical or just regular adults that are having challenges with insomnia. It's you want the bed to become this like safe place that it's okay to sort of surrender to the feeling of wanting to sleep. That means not feeling like you're up in bed. And like, if you're really not ready for bed, being up and just being in bed is kind of mixing up those messages a bit. So it's really sort of incorporating a bit of cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. I love that that's your number one recommendation. Ooh, tell us more.
Oh, yeah. And then, I mean, I think that the screens, the light, not just the blue light, but the whatever you're watching on the screen, the video game, the news.
No news, please.
Oh. No news. No news before bedtime. No, nothing political, right? So I think that's super important. Transitioning from the day to the night. For me, it's a warm bath. It can be coloring, or for kids, it could be building Legos or music or whatever, something that just kind of gets you out of the day and into the night and says, okay, it's time for bed now. And then what you do during the day, exercise is great, not super close to bedtime, but I like it before dinner or earlier in the day. It really does promote sleep. And then I guess my other one would be caffeine, you know, really watch it. Iced tea has caffeine, soda. Just really being aware, chocolate, just being aware of all that has caffeine. And that can also really mess with our sleep as well. So those would be my recommendations.
I love them all. Oh my goodness. And these are behavioral recommendations that really do apply to everyone across the board. I think you and I can both agree. If I sit on my Pitocus all day, it's much harder to go to sleep than if I've had a good workout. So, and it also just helps with weight management too, right? Because some folks, if you're on medications, that may lead, as you pointed out, to gaining weight. And then if you are naturally more prone to wanting to be a little bit more sedentary, that can affect you as well. I have to tell you, this has been such a fun discussion. I truly appreciate your time. I want to say that I'm thankful to you. I'm thankful to our listeners for sticking with us. I hope that you learned a lot. If you want to find Dr. Mallow, she's over at Vanderbilt. She's just an amazing resource. Keep doing what you are doing, my lady. Please make us smarter and better at this, and just more accepting of the fact that we're all a little bit different. We all have things that are unique. We're all on a spectrum of one kind or another. I love that. Hello to all my fellow sleep biohackers out there. I have a call to action for you. If you are enjoying this podcast, if you feel that you are growing, you're more knowledgeable, you're feeling empowered about your sleep, that is the purpose. So please, please take the time to like and review the podcast, share it amongst your friends and family. Please follow me. If you'd like to follow me on Instagram or Facebook, I am there as well. My handle on Instagram and TikTok is AskTheSleepMD. And you can also go to my website, AskTheSleepMD.com, for more information about each of these episodes. We will be sharing with you cited articles that you can actually refer to and read yourself if you like, and lots of juicy tidbits about how to sleep better. Thank you. This podcast is made possible with the exquisite talents of Mr. Joey Salvia, my producer, Mr. Adrian Pederath, my creative director, and music by Lori Kunzel of kunzelmusic.com. Disclaimer: The statements made on this podcast have not been evaluated by the U.S. Food or Drug Administration. They are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent disease. The information provided by this podcast should not be used as individual medical advice. While I am a practicing sleep provider, I am not your sleep provider. You should always consult with your personal healthcare provider for individual recommendations and treatment.